Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org.
Not for me anymore. It's too fast for me, or no, it's not too fast. Then I change my mind about that. It's not this, it's not that. It's just not for me.
Broadway legend, actress, singer Elaine Stritch, who died yesterday at the age of 89. That clip from the WNYC podcast, Here's the Thing, hosted by Alec Baldwin. Stritch and Baldwin were close friends, and of course, Stritch played Baldwin's cantankerous mother on the NBC series 30 Rock. Alec Baldwin is here with us now to remember his friend and TV mom, Elaine Stritch. Hey, Alec, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. You want to talk about that clip we just played? Were you surprised? Because she seems like such, you know, the quintessential New Yorker.
Well, I think that, if she had worked more consistently and her health was better, I think it was all of one for her toward the end. She was starting to get a little tired and she wasn't feeling very well and getting around was hard. And she would tell you privately or not so privately, but that arrangement that she had at the Carlisle to have a home there at a very favorable rate, they were very kind to her. Part of the deal was she would perform there for 6 weeks out of the year. And she said that she got too tired to do that. And, the last performance she did at the Carlisle, she did struggle to remember her lines and her lyrics and everything. So she just was getting, I think, very tired.
Were you personally close?
Well, I mean, in the way that people in this business are forced to pick up where you left off. You know, there's people who, when you see them, you do pick up where you left off and you really love them and you have a very positive experience. And especially if you admire them, you know, like, in this business, I find talent is the ultimate aphrodisiac. And so when you meet someone, you have a great time with them if you had a good work experience. And no one was funnier and had better timing than Elaine. And I just sent Tina an email yesterday saying, I'll always be grateful to you for casting her as my mom, because she would walk in there and we just had to stand back and get out of her way and the rest of it took care of itself.
Did the relationship between the characters develop over time as you played those edgy roles?
Well, Elaine is somebody who, if you could give it back, she loved if you could give it back to her. She didn't want to bully people as acerbic as she could be. She didn't necessarily want to, she wanted you to give it back, you know. So if you did give it back, if you did put her on a bit, she loved it. She loved it. And in the documentary, I think she calls me Joan Crawford in the documentary because I was late for a scene one day. And we gave it to her just as well. We really did. And Elaine was somebody who is from that old school where she worked with Coward and she worked with Sondheim. And I think as she got older, all of us as we get older, there aren't as many good parts, let's say. And so you often think back. You think back about the time of you that was great. And, she was very fond of and very proud of Coward especially, but she loved Sondheim's work. But she spoke so fondly of Coward as a friend. And I can't even imagine having the life she had. She worked with some really, really great people.
Unbelievable. You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Brian Lehrer, very honored to have Alec Baldwin for a few minutes remembering his TV mom from 30 Rock, Elaine Stritch. And here's a clip of you and her together, not from your podcast conversation, which we'll sample from a little more later, but from 30 Rock, from Season 2, Episode 9.
Jack, what the hell are you up to?
Mother, I'm sorry, but the Lemons invited me out, and I couldn't say no. They're very nice people.
Oh, nice. I'll show you nice. Let's all meet down at the soda shop while this country turns into Mexico.
Now, you see, they don't say things like that. They're very polite to each other.
I suppose you think that they're more nurturing than I am.
Mother, there are terrorist cells that are more nurturing than you are.
Be careful. I'll cry.
You know, I think sometimes that the relationship was more like grumpy old siblings or, you know, a grumpy old couple than mother and son, as exemplified there.
I always remember someone once said about Jimmy Connors. They said his mother would play tennis with him, and she would hit the ball right at him as hard as she could at the line. She'd hit him right in the face or the body or whatever. And she'd say, remember, Jimmy, even your own mother will hit you with it if it's going to score a point. You know, to toughen him up. Now, I don't know if that story's true, by the way. I mean, I remember reading it somewhere. But I always like to think of Elaine's character as Jimmy Connor's mother in the corporate world. You know, she wanted to toughen me up for them.
And so what about your relationship as actors in that respect? Because not that you're a shrinking violet, but she, as another generation of legend, Elaine Stritch, was she intimidating to perform next to at all?
I mean, I think that you wanted to, you know, the Elaine that we worked with, I mean, I saw Elaine do her one-woman show at Liberty, mm-hmm. and I was at the opening at the Public Theater before they moved to Broadway and George Wolf directed. And I say this without any hyperbole, you know, everybody in the city who was in town that night showed up to this event. She had many, many admirers in the business and colleagues. And the applause just lifted the building off the ground. And she comes out there for 80 minutes or 90 minutes or whatever it was and performs this. And all the energy and memorizing all the lines and so forth. But then when we did the show with Elaine, she was slightly different. You know, she wasn't as, she couldn't remember her lines as well, and she was mm-hmm. fatigued and so forth.
Years later.
But the thing about her was, like, very, very talented people like that, she would stumble for takes 2, 3, and 4 and so forth. But you get her to take 5, 6, or 7, and she just nailed it. Mm. And we would just all sit there and look at each other and go, well, that was worth it. You know, she was always worth it. She was always worth the time it took to let her find her way.
Which I think relates to this next clip that we're going to play from your interview with her on your Here's the Thing podcast. Elaine Stritch talking about her work ethic, including never saying no to anything.
I was always engaged.
Always.
Always.
You never took a part.
I was leading up to it or coming down. You know, I was trying to get it behind me.
You never regretted doing anything?
Never. No.
Wow. That's incredible.
No, I never regretted doing anything on the stage.
Never?
Uh-uh.
How was that possible?
Because I just won every time I walked out there.
Right.
You know that old expression about I own the stage.
Right.
Hey, Alec, that is some line. I won every time I walked out there. Is that
right,
supreme
right.
confidence, or is that just her loving the stage?
I think for people who are a certain kind of actor, you know, where you love the relationship with the audience and you love the possibilities there and you love the process involved of rehearsal and so forth, the stage does trump anything else. I mean, listen, I know actors who are very talented and they're very successful who don't really like acting. You know, the acting part of it is something that they want to get over with as quickly as possible so they can carry on with the lifestyle of the actor. And then there's actors I know who rehearsals and techs and previews and going out every night and honing something and doing it better and better is just heaven to them. And
Where are you on that scale?
Well, I do like the theater more than film in the sense of only in that sense that, you know, what other job do you have where you go out there every night and you know exactly what you're going to say, you know exactly what the other person's going to say, and you know exactly when everybody's going to laugh, and then you go to Orso and have dinner. You know, it's all pretty comfortable. It's work. I mean, there's hard work involved, but there's a ritual to it that I really, really like. But about Elaine and in terms of that clip, there's also someone who, Elaine was a fan and an admirer of people. You know, like nowadays, you know, when I first started, to understand who went before you and who they were and what their contribution was important. And some of that seems to be lost with younger people today. And Elaine was somebody who loved everyone who went before her, loved everyone that she admired, who she worked with, and was a great student and a great observer of people who were young and new. So she just loved the business, and she loved everyone in it that she worked with.
And even though we just heard that clip where she was so confident, you did get her in your interview to open up about her fears as well. So we're going to play another clip from the Here's the Thing interview that's a little bit different.
Success is lovely. It's so hard, and it's such hard work, but it's so gratifying.
What's the hardest thing about it for you? What's been the hardest thing? Do you find it hard just to have that
fear,
much focus on
the
it?
Fear.
The fear of what? That you won't be able to perform?
The fear that I'm just going to forget, and I'm going to not so much forget, but it's the fear. It's the fear. And that was when I was not drinking at all, and I didn't drink anything to get my talent out. But all my life I had.
Alec, what was the fear? The fear of what? Of bombing?
Well, I think for Elaine, it's the fear that whatever that intangible thing that happens between the audience and the performer, the fear that it wasn't going to happen that night. You know, when you walk out there, when you go to the theater and you see people who they barely have to move their hand, they just kind of do some small gesture, and the audience goes crazy. If you're Angela Lansbury or Patti LuPone or someone who's a great goddess or god in the theater, you know, and Elaine was certainly one of those people, and you're always afraid that that's going to end. The goodwill that audiences extend to you. I mean, Elaine is somebody who, she walked on stage, and people went nuts. She got standing ovations and round and entry applause, and she was the beneficiary of a great deal of love and admiration from people, and I think she was worried, as people often are, that that would go away.
Before you go, on Facebook, we asked listeners for their questions about your on-camera relationship with Stritch. Amy posted, they were amazing together on 30 Rock, obviously tumultuous and dysfunctional, yet hysterical. What were their off-screen interactions like? I think we've done some of that. Eric asked, did Alec ever marvel at how much energy she seemed to have?
Yes, because Elaine was somebody who, I've seen this kind of performer before, this kind of actor or actress before, where she gets up in the morning and she's performing. And she's on. She kind of turns an on switch from the moment she wakes up in the morning to the moment the day is over. When she was at work, she was very gregarious and funny and telling stories and anecdotes and jokes. She was very much alive before and after they rolled the camera. And then I think at the end of the day, she went back to the hotel and collapsed. But I mean this in every positive way. A day of shooting with Elaine was a very full day. It was a very full day and a very memorable day. And I will say that there is a magic to casting. I mean, you find someone, everybody always says, well, there's never one actor to play a part, and there's other people who could have done different things with it. But for the purposes of 30 Rock, and I'll always, tip my hat, as always, to Tina and to Robert Carlock and everyone who wrote the show, there really was no one else who could play this part but Elaine. She came to work, and no matter how slow the day went, because Elaine maybe wasn't feeling well, it was always worth it in the end, because it was just gold at the end. She was just the funniest damn woman you'd ever met in your life. So there you have it.
So there we have it. Alec Baldwin, so special of you to give us a few minutes to remember Elaine Stritch today. We really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Brian. Thank you.
And listeners, the full interview between Alec Baldwin and Elaine Stritch from his WNYC podcast, Here's the Thing, is available on our website, WNYC.org. And we'll go out with this. Just 2 years ago, Elaine Stritch performed at the White House for the president and his guests. It was for a Broadway celebration, and she sang Sondheim's song, I'm Still Here, one of her signatures. And she joked that she thought nobody should sing that song until they were 80, but that she was singing for the president that night and couldn't wait 20 years. So here she is.
Good times and bum times, I've seen them all, my dear. Still here. Black velvet sometimes. Sometimes just pretzels and beer. But I'm here.
I've run the gamut.
I've run the gamut. A to Z. Three cheers and damn it. Say lovey. I got through all the last year.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So drones are a hot-button issue when it comes to our military. Everybody knows that. But they're also becoming more controversial right in our backyard. More and more people are buying and using non-weaponized personal drones here in America. In New York City this month, the NYPD arrested two drone pilots and charged them with felony reckless endangerment. They claim that the pilots almost collided with an NYPD helicopter near the George Washington Bridge. For their part, the two men claim they did nothing wrong, and the NYPD chased them down. So regardless of who's at fault in this particular circumstance, it brings up the question, what are the laws that govern drone use in New York City? And who needs drones as personal possessions anyway? Gregory McNeil is here today to answer these questions. He's a law professor at Pepperdine University and a contributor to Forbes. Professor, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
And listeners, we're going to open up the phones on this. Anybody listening who has a drone that you use or plan to use, 212-433-WNYC. Anybody have a funny, interesting, even scary or disturbing story about seeing a drone like outside your window on some New York City street, 212-433-WNYC, or anywhere in the metro area for that matter, 212-433-9692, on personal drone possession in our area, 212-433-9692. So, Professor, is it legal to fly drones in New York City?
So there are two ways that we can regulate the use of drones. And when we talk about drones, for the listeners who aren't familiar with the technology, we're really talking about remote control helicopters that you can buy on Amazon. So the popular one is known as a DJI Phantom. I mean, they fly really fast. They can fly pretty far away. They're very sophisticated. They're a couple $100s, but that's the kind of thing we're talking about.
A couple of $100s is nothing. That's like a toy.
Yeah. I mean, you go on Amazon right now. They're a ton of fun, too. I mean,
How big are they?
The Phantom is about 16 inches across, weighs under 2 pounds. I mean, so we're talking about a pretty small thing, flies for about 20 minutes. You can put a GoPro camera on it, and you can get some pretty good footage. But otherwise, we're not really talking about big systems. They have big ones, but nobody's flying the big ones. The guys that got arrested over the GW Bridge, they were flying one of the small Phantoms. You could buy them in electronic stores in the city. And so this is the type of thing that we use the word drone because it's more sophisticated than RC helicopter, but that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. There are two ways to regulate it right now, and there's some uncertainty. First is the FAA says you can fly these things, but only for fun. So if you're flying it for your real estate business, filming some new property, you want to show the vistas and the vantage points out of the high-rise apartment building, that's not allowed because it's commercial use. But if you want to do the same thing so that you can show the pictures to your buddies about the great new place that you bought, the FAA says that that's fine.
Why would that be the dividing line?
It's a weird thing in the law dating back about a decade where the FAA didn't want to go after people who used model airplanes and model helicopters. They didn't want to go after the hobbyists. They didn't want to be in the business of policing that. And so what they decided to do was they said, if you're a hobbyist, you follow these voluntary guidelines in this advisory circular, and if you're doing it for a business, well, then the hobbyist rules don't apply to you.
Or maybe it's to protect the special terrestrial photography industry interest.
You know, I thought that, but I really think it was actually the other way around to protect the model aircraft engine. Because the hobbyists have like 170,000 people in their own like lobbying arm. Yeah. So they're their own special interest. But what that does, the FAA, by having that hands-off approach, what you have in most states for decades now is that states and cities have said, okay, well, you know, if you're in Texas or something, they don't have any rules mostly governing this type of thing in open spaces. But if you're in a city, usually what happens is they establish model aircraft fields. And New York City has these. There are some in Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, places where they have a specific field where you can fly your aircraft and do whatever you want.
Yep.
And most of the time what happened was model aircraft operators went to those fields. But now you've got guys who aren't hobbyists. They go on Amazon or they go to the local electronics store and they buy one of these things for a couple $100 that I'm talking about. And they're not part of that community, so they say, you know, I'll just go out on the street and I'll fly it up and down Broadway and take some pictures of the cars and the people and whatnot.
And you can or you can or you can't.
Well, so there are a bunch of news stories that say that there's an ordinance in New York City that prohibits this. I have dug through the ordinances, and I haven't found anything. But what NYPD says is if you're endangering people, right, if you're creating a risk that someone might get hurt, not that you're actually hurting anyone, just creating the risk, then we might come after you with reckless endangerment. It's hard for them to prove the case once they cite you and it goes to court. But as most of us know, you know, you can beat the rap, but you can't beat the ride. And oftentimes the getting the citation and having to fight it is deterrent enough for you to just land the thing when the officer comes up and tells you to stop. I mean, most of us aren't gonna fight with the NYPD when they're telling you to stop doing something.
Here's a drone owner, I think. Joe in Ocean County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you have?
I have a small drone, as you call it, a remote control helicopter. And I just wanted to make a comment about the accessibility. I mean, you could buy these things from, you know, they have the small commercial helicopters you can buy for $20 anywhere up to, you know, in the thousands.
How do you use yours?
They're getting so popular to the point that, you know, just on my block alone, there's five people that have them.
Wow. So
they can be, I mean, they're relatively safe, and you kind of got to know what you're doing, but they are a little hard to learn how to fly at first, and I would definitely recommend doing it in a non-crowded area. But obviously, a lot of people aren't that intelligent. So
how do you use yours, and how do you think your neighbors use theirs?
I just use mine, and obviously not when there's a ton of people around. But I live on the water, so I fly it over the water and around the lagoon, and you know, over in my front yard, just around the neighborhood.
Just for the fun of watching it fly around.
Right.
Joe, thank you very much. Brandon in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
So I'm an attorney that actually defends drone operators, and one of the things I think that has often been overlooked in this whole discussion and absent from the media are all the positive uses for this technology. I have a client who uses drones to search for missing people. They've actually done that successfully. And I'd be curious to know what Professor McNeil thinks about the positive uses of this technology.
Professor?
Brendan, good. And I think that's Brendan Shulman of Kramer Levin, who's the most famous. He's underselling himself. He's the most famous drone lawyer in the country. He took on the FAA and he won. So he's really, I'm just happened to be a lawyer. His case is this amazing case of Texas Equisearch is the name of the case. I mean, they go out and they find missing children. And they've had a successful record of finding missing people, and the FAA says this is the kind of thing that can't be allowed because they say it's a commercial use, even though it's being operated by a nonprofit organization. That's just one great example of this. I mean, the real estate drones is a great commercial example of something where banning the realtors from filming properties doesn't make much sense when you're going to allow people to fly them for fun, you know, to do loop-de-loops. But the guy who's got an insurance policy and his business interest on the line, you're not going to allow him to fly it. To me, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So there are tons of positive uses. Give you another one. Let's say that you're worried about pollution in the Hudson River, and normally what you'd have to do is you'd have to try and go out and take a bunch of water samples from a few different places. So you'd need a bunch of city workers to go out and do that over a period of time. They have drones now that could fly out, land on the water, pick up the water sample, fly to the next place, pick up the water sample, and in 2 hours you could do what would take people 3 or 4 days. So the technology is really amazing.
So let me ask Brent, if you're really the Derek Jeter of drone lawyers, what do you think the regulatory framework, if any, should be? If we have, like our last caller, five people on his block own these remote control helicopters, you know, does there need to be some kind of regulation, if not the exact same way with air traffic control and the big airplanes, something to keep people safe?
Well, I think there are two issues. There's privacy, and then there's liability and safety. For decades, people have dealt with the safety issue through the tort system, through personal injury claims, and that really gets resolved and has been resolved for a long time that way. The privacy issues, I think, in many respects are overblown. We already have laws on the books concerning peeping Tom laws, trespass, intrusion upon seclusion. So the extent that people are actually invading privacy using these devices, which I think is really rare, we have means to address it. And I don't think that we should discriminate against a specific technology. It's the inappropriate conduct that should be the target of legislation.
So when the NYPD went after these two pilots for reckless endangerment because of the way they were flying around the George Washington Bridge, and I guess there was a crash with an NYPD helicopter, would that fall under that?
Well, first of all, those are not the facts. The facts are they were flying in their neighborhood and the helicopter came to them. At least that's what I've read, according to the ATC transcript. But I think it's absolutely true that people should not be flying near manned aircraft. There are plenty of other places to fly, including designated sites right here in New York City, like Floyd Bennett Field. There's a great club there. There's another club that's along the East River. There are places to do this, and I think the last thing we want is regulation that intrudes upon this great science and technology hobby. I mean, people and students in the city are learning science and technology and engineering and math and actually entering robotics competitions using these devices. If we were to restrict them in the city, I think it would be a great detriment to our students.
Brendan, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. We're going to sneak in one more caller here, and it's Stephen in Queens, who I'm told is an Air Force pilot who also flies drones. Is that right, Stephen?
Yes. I remember I was talking to you last year on April Fool's Day. I think the bottom line, everybody have to really concern is the insurance, because we build drones and we fly for NYPD and New York Fire Department. In 1 day demonstration, we have to carry $1.2 billion insurance. And I saw many, many people in the flying field in the modern helicopter got the head chopped off. 6 months ago, there's a kid flying a model helicopter and killed himself in Brooklyn. So it's the insurance and safety that I'm concerned. You can debate all you want, but that's I want to get that point out.
So do you think the private sector can take care of this through rising insurance costs after there are a number of horrible accidents as opposed to a regulatory system? Is that what you're arguing?
But basically, if you take any remote control airplane without following regulation called the EAA, you have to join a member, they give you a rule. But if you go out and hurt somebody, if I see Amazon drone come over, I would stick my hand up and chop my finger off and own Amazon.
Own Amazon after the lawsuit. Stephen, I understand. So, Professor, as a law professor, and we've just got a minute left, hearkening back to our last segment on Sheldon Silver, maybe it all comes down to tort lawyers.
Well, you know, so the regulatory scheme that a lot of supporters of the technology are supporting is one that establishes safe operating guidelines and requires individuals to carry insurance. If you have a drone right now and you're operating in the city, you can get an insurance policy with like a $2 million liability coverage for under $1,000. If you join the Academy of Model Aeronautics, they have their own insurance policy that comes with your membership fee, and the membership fee is like $100. And so there are ways to deal with these types of risks. I wouldn't recommend anybody go sacrificing their hand to try and own Amazon. It's probably a bad idea. But I would recommend that people get insurance. I mean, it's an easy thing to do. You just Google drone insurance or UAV insurance, and a bunch of providers come up who are already providing this type of coverage.
And we leave it there. Don't forget to buy your drone insurance, folks. Gregory McNeil, law professor at Pepperdine University School of Law and a contributor to Forbes. Professor, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Graham Lehrer on WNYC, and 50 years ago today, the police shooting of a 15-year-old black student sparked a six-day riot in Harlem. Days of violence in New York City. This is a clip from the WNYC archives of then New York NAACP leader Basil Paterson, recorded in July of 1964 on why it happened.
First of all, the warning was given to Commissioner Murphy that Harlem was a powder keg a long time ago. And his only response was, I attended a dinner no more than 2 months ago. Well, his response was, don't worry about a long, hot summer. We're going to have a cool, calm, constructive summer. But if the worst comes, we're prepared. I think that anybody who was in Harlem over the last weekend knows that the police department was not prepared.
That was Basil Paterson the year before he was elected to the New York State Senate at a panel discussion on July 26, 1964, that aired on the station called Who Speaks for Harlem? We got that today courtesy of the New York City Municipal Archive. The panel was convened in response to those Harlem riots that we're about to revisit now as part of our 50-year civil rights history series. On July 16th, 1964, 50 years ago today, a 15-year-old black student, James Powell, was shot and killed by an off-duty white police officer, Lieutenant Thomas Gilligan. Hundreds of his classmates took to the street in protest. By July 18th, the protests turned to much more violence. For six nights, Harlem and Bed-Stuy were barraged with looting and rioting and police brutality. In the end, one person was dead and several hundred were left injured and arrested. This was one of several race riots that took place around the country in that so-called long, hot summer of 1964. We will play some more clips from the archive from that time coming up. But what is the 1964 Harlem riots legacy 50 years later? With us now are Peniel Joseph, professor of history at Tufts University, who has been doing the occasional 50-year civil rights history series with us since last year, and David Paterson, former governor of New York, and son of Basil Paterson, who you just heard in that clip and we'll hear more of coming up. Peniel Joseph, David Paterson, welcome back to WNYC. Hi there.
Thank you, Brian.
Hey, Brian.
And let me jump right in to this question for you, David Paterson. We heard that 50-year-old clip of your father. We'll hear some more from him in a minute. You were a little kid. Do you remember the incident and the riots?
I remember the whole thing. And I remember that it wasn't just the shooting of the young man, James Powell, who was 15. It was that the police officer, Gilligan, was alleged to have kicked the body to make sure he was dead. And that single act started a riot on the scene. And, you know, what's interesting about this is that, you know, in 1992, after the Rodney King decision, there were some riots all over the country. And, you know, there have been other incidents where people's outrage about verdicts and that type of thing spilled over. But this was a direct response to an act of brutality that people in that neighborhood in Harlem believed to be unnecessary. And it was a continuation of a treatment of the Harlem community and Harlem's all over New York State by the police. Now, what's interesting is that it was stunning, I must tell you, Brian, to hear that quote from my father, who passed away on April 16th of this year. But only last year was I informed by him, and it was after the verdict in the George Zimmerman acquittal, that when my father was 16 years old, he was pistol-whipped by a police officer openly in public, and that the NAACP came to his home and asked his family if they would participate in a lawsuit, and his father would not permit them to do it because he said, the police know who my son is, and as soon as there's a lawsuit, something else is going to happen to him. And that's the kind of feeling of that could become latent in terms of reacting in the way people reacted many years later, just decades of abuse.
It's an incredible story. Peniel Joseph, you're younger. You were not around at the time, but, of course, you're a historian of this kind of thing. More of our history series together has been focused on the South when we talk about civil rights and that era. Have you studied Harlem 1964?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I write about this in my first book, Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, Brian. And the interesting thing is that on July 19th, 3 days after Gilligan shoots James Powell, there's a massive meeting in Harlem at Mount Morris Presbyterian Church. And there's going to be community activists, people like Jesse Gray, the Harlem rent strike leader, and people from CORE. The street speaker, Eddie Porkchop Davis, is there. And so is Bayard Rustin and James Farmer of CORE. And what's interesting is that the theme of the meeting is Harlem, Mississippi? That's the question. So this is the same summer of Freedom Summer, which we just talked about 2 weeks ago. And the violence is triggered by police brutality. And that summer, not only does Harlem burn, but St. Louis and Rochester, New York, parts of New Jersey and Philadelphia as well. So the interesting thing about 64 in a way is ground zero for the urban riots or rebellions or civil disturbances, depending on your ideological perspective, that we're going to see in the 60s. But we had really started seeing this, Brian, in 63 in Birmingham, right? So the rioting actually starts first in the South and spreads north. But it's very important that it's police brutality, but that it's also poverty that is connected to these riots or these rebellions in 64.
Listeners, anyone listening right now who was around for the Harlem riots, maybe Harlem resident at that time or Bedford-Stuyvesant, where some of this also took place, though they got known as the Harlem riots, we would like to hear your memories. 212-433-WNYC.
You know,
maybe you were a participant.
You know, Brian, it's very interesting that on that same date that Peniel refers to, July 19th, when they had this meeting, earlier that day, Gabe Pressman from WNBC-TV interviewed James Farmer, Bayard Rustin, a well-known civil rights leader named Cleveland Robinson, and my father, Basil Patterson, on an hour-long program on his regular Sunday show, and it featured this type of discussion. And what the participants thought was interesting is they never could get on the show to talk about some of the problems right in New York City, and it was a local show, until there was a riot.
Until there was a riot. And you know what? We have several excerpts, I don't know if you knew this, from that show. So let's play one right now. This is another minute and a half of your father. I think this is the exact show that you're talking about. This is an NBC show, and it's Basil Patterson. From the archives, July 26, 1964, from a panel discussion called Who Speaks for Harlem?
There's almost a chronicle of events that's occurred. We had initially the call for new legislation by Governor Rockefeller. Now, the people in Harlem interpreted those two new laws, and the ones I'm referring to specifically, of course, are the so-called stop and search law and the no-knock search warrant bill. Now, these laws went into effect amid a hue and cry against them from Harlem. Only Harlem seemed to be opposing them. There are many people, and quite frankly, it's very interesting to many of us who followed the progress on these bills, that seems to be accepted by many persons who seem to be rather well-versed in constitutional law, that at least one of them is definitely unconstitutional, the stop and search. And yet, it seemed it became an issue whether it's going to be the people of Harlem opposing these bills or whether they're going to be passed under the aegis of the law enforcement officials. Now, the people of Harlem objected to this, but it went right ahead. There were not even real hearings in the state legislature. We followed this up, and we came down to support the Weiss bill in the city council. And at that time, those of us who were there spent 8.5 hours trying to get our message across that if even the police brutality that has been practiced was being exaggerated, here was an opportunity for the city administration to at least say to the people, we are going to give you an opportunity to make your complaints. And what did we see? A demonstration by New York City Police Department en masse at City Hall opposing and objecting.
So Basil Patterson, July 26, 1964. David Patterson with us now, and historian Peniel Joseph. Governor, was this from the same show that you were thinking of? First question.
Yes, I remember that the show was on a Sunday, and it was, I guess, about a week after the meeting that Peniel was referring to.
And second question, did you hear him refer to the constitutionally questionable practice of stop and search? Does that sound a little familiar?
Here we are 50 years later, still debating that issue. But you see, what I think is the case now is there have been similar incidents. There's the Romali Graham shooting in the Bronx and that type of thing. But the reason that you don't see people taking to the streets the way you used to is that now many of them are in the government. There are places to go. There are people, even in the police department itself, who understand the problem. And I think once that happens, you get a much different reaction than you might have 50 years ago.
And we have more clips from the archive to play. One of the activists who you mentioned, Jesse Gray, and one of then-Mayor Robert Wagner. But Peniel Joseph, do you want to piggyback on what David Patterson was just saying about the difference between now and then?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I think what's interesting 50 years ago is that when we look at this from a panoramic perspective, people like Basil Patterson, who are real heroic activists, there were also local leaders, Mae Mallory, William Epton, Conrad Lynn, Jesse Gray, all these activists who wanted to talk about issues of race and police brutality and economic justice. And this riot really provided a context for them to have that conversation. At the national level, we should remember Lyndon Johnson sends the FBI into Harlem on Monday, July 20th. And the day after Basil Patterson and that news show was on, Martin Luther King Jr. arrives in Harlem Monday, July 27th, and he tries to broker a peace treaty between City Hall and Harlem activists. And King asks for a civilian review board, which is something that Basil Patterson and other activists in Harlem wanted. That doesn't happen, but there's going to be really national rallies in support of Harlem, but the newspapers are going to complain that this is all a communist conspiracy, which is very, very interesting as well. One thing we should note, too, is Malcolm X, who many people look to as a leader, was actually in Africa when the riots occurred. He's in Cairo with the Organization of African Unity, pleading with the OAU to look upon the black struggle in America as a human rights struggle and not just a civil rights struggle.
And the mayor of New York at the time, Robert Wagner, was in Geneva, Switzerland when the riots broke out. Ironically, he was there, quote, to make an address on poverty and unemployment as related to discrimination and civil rights, unquote. That was the official billing of his speech at an international conference. Meanwhile, race riots were happening in his own backyard. And here's 45 seconds of what Mayor Wagner had to say from there.
Of all of the groups in America, Negroes have the most to gain from law and order. The Supreme Court decision of 1954 is law and order. Where would civil rights be without that decision, without that law and order? The Civil Rights Bill just passed in Congress and signed by President Johnson is law and order. The New York City law outlawing discrimination in housing, passed under my administration, is law and order. Without law and order, Negro and civil rights progress would be set back half a century. Law and order are the Negro's best friend. Make no mistake about that.
Law and order, which for people who know the history of that time was a phrase that didn't just mean law and didn't just mean order, but it was kind of a code word used by segregationist governors in the South at the time. Very surprising to hear it out of the mouth of the New York City mayor of the time. But here in response, we go back to that Channel 4 Gay Pressman special for a clip of Jesse Gray responding directly as an activist identified on the show as a, quote, Negro leader, responding to Mayor Wagner.
I don't know what the mayor is talking about. Law and order is always essential. But law and order is one thing. It's one thing when the cops are shooting down your women and children. You're a poor man, and you're a man with no guts to stand by and see your women and children being fired upon and shot down without doing something about it. And if he called law and order standing by while the women and children were being shot down by a mass of screaming racist police, well, then the mayor's sick like he has always been.
Jesse Gray, and my understanding, just to be really clear about what media we're talking about here, that was, I believe, from a documentary that followed the Gay Pressman panel discussion. And our archivist tells us that in some context, we think that Channel 4 then gave WNYC, then the municipally owned radio station, permission to rebroadcast some of it because it was so important and so special. So that's a little of the archival history. Peniel, Joseph, do you want to talk about the phrase law and order at the in the context of that time?
Oh, certainly. In the 1960s, and Richard Nixon is going to use this brilliantly, law and order is code for containing black protest and black perceptions of black violence and black rage as well. So when we think about the mayor, New York City mayor, and this is 18 months before John Lindsay becomes sort of the young liberal mayor of New York City for two terms, a northern mayor using that is very, very telling. But when we go back to Jesse Gray, Gray is part, along with people like Basil Patterson, Gray is a grassroots activist, whereas Basil Patterson is part of that generation that really got access and became state representatives. They were head of the NAACP. People like Percy Sutton, Basil Patterson, David Dinkins. So those were very, very heroic figures who were trying to be incorporated and gain access to these political institutions. People like Jesse Gray and Bill Epton and Mae Mallory, these were your street organizers and your street fighters. And they all come together, including with Dr. King, to express their outrage at what happens in Harlem. And there's actually great footage of tape of Lyndon Johnson speaking about the Harlem riots with J. Edgar Hoover, because he's trying to figure out what to do, should he send the FBI in? And eventually he sends the FBI in, and they're trying to investigate connections between whether the black Muslims and other extremist groups were behind this. So the interesting part about this, the riot is spontaneous. It's because of all this oppression, but the government is trying to figure out, is there a black militant who somehow has spurred this riot through remote control or some group that's going to start guerrilla warfare right here in the U.S.?
So one more.
And also the main thrust is to try to connect it to the Communist Party.
Yes.
And there were a number of civil rights leaders that did have a connection with the Communist Party. And although now it's almost anachronistic, when you're being abused at this level, who cares what party it is that's coming in if they appear to be helping? Remember, we were helping Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan when we thought we were fighting communism. So, you know, the title communist was just put on anybody that you didn't like to try to prevent them from being heard.
Oh, and they still call Obama a Marxist today. That same language
yes.
gets used for whatever, you know, non-right-wing policy.
People Although it lacks attraction these days.
I guess, in most circles. We have a minute left. Let's see. David Patterson, all right, clear something up for us. Your father's name, Basil or Basil?
His name was Basil.
I always yes. thought Basil was the spice, Basil was the name. So
yes.
So I guess, do you want to say a word about, since he did pass this year, his legacy and your career in the shadow and, you know, building on him in the next generation? We have about 45 seconds.
Well, I think that now the Dinkins and Rangel, the Gang of Four and all that, they're perceived as these kind of like power brokers politically. But when you really examine history, as Peniel does all the time, you see that they were the activists of their day, and they were considered in their day the way one might have considered perhaps Reverend Al Sharpton and others of, mm-hmm. of a modern era. But they had to be that way. It was the only way to try to fight an oppressive segregation that still existed even though the Supreme Court decisions were made.
The Harlem riots.
Yeah,
go ahead, Peniel. 15
and when
seconds.
We think about the gentrification of Harlem right now in 2014, it's important to understand the journey that Harlem has taken in terms of this struggle for racial economic justice.
Tufts University historian Peniel Joseph will continue to join us from time to time as we do our occasional 50-year civil rights series spanning from 1963 to 1965, so through 2015 here in the series. And former Governor David Patterson, great to talk to both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. It's a wonderful show.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.